Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, June 16th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Our central thesis today is that the era of predictable liquidity is over, replaced by a structural regime of heightened credit and capital risk. We are moving from a period of stable, low-interest benchmarks into a landscape where geopolitical volatility dictates every margin call.
So the era of cheap, easy money has officially hit a wall.
Precisely.
$10 billion in institutional orders for a single IPO, and we haven't even seen the final prospectus for SpaceX yet. Today, we're looking at the new era of capital and credit risk, specifically how the massive influx of tech-driven equity is rewriting the rules for commodities, energy, and the very concept of debt.
It's a fundamental restructuring of how capital flows into the physical world.
It's the kind of market shift that makes you wonder if we'll be seeing a total collapse of the tech sector, a complete evaporation of liquidity in the energy markets, or just a sudden, inexplicable spike in the price of premium lithium-ion batteries.
Well, the plumbing is certainly under pressure. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts have been tracking how the sheer scale of these upcoming issuances. We're talking about a potential $150 billion to $250 billion wave from entities like SpaceX, OpenAI, and Anthropic, is creating a massive indigestion in the markets. The mechanism here is a supply-demand imbalance. When you drop that much new equity onto the market, investors don't necessarily find new cash. They often have to liquidate existing holdings in the Magnificent Seven to fund the new entries.
So the Magnificent Seven are essentially being cannibalized to feed the new gods of AI and space exploration.
Worth noting, it's not just about the new names. Eric Townsend has pointed out that the real systemic threat isn't just the $250 billion in upcoming IPOs, but the $3 trillion overhang of restricted shares from private equity founders and VCs that is scheduled to unlock by the end of 2027. This creates a cascading sell pressure. As these shares move from restricted to unrestricted status, the sudden increase in float forces massive, systematic selling to maintain price equilibrium.
And for the commodities crowd, this sounds like a massive tug of war for the same pool of dollars.
It is.
And that tug of war is shifting the very nature of how industrial projects get funded. We're seeing a transition from a debt-centric model to an equity-centric one. As Stuart Kaiser noted, a massive global construction and industrial cycle is creating immense capital needs, but because the cost of debt has been so volatile, the market is pivoting toward equity financing. This is particularly visible in the energy transition. You see a clean barbell valuation gap, as noted by Sightline Climate, where mature power services companies like Legence or Erock trade at a reasonable 8.8 times revenue, while deep tech generation plays like Fervo Energy are commanding astronomical multiples of roughly 41,000 times revenue.
Wait, 41,000 times revenue. Are we investing in power companies or lottery tickets?
It looks like the latter, but the capital is moving there because that's where the infrastructure is being built. However, the risk is migrating. While the focus has been on equity concentration, the debt side is getting just as crowded. Large-scale hyperscalers have already issued nearly $17 billion in debt this year alone. The risk is that credit markets are beginning to mirror the high concentration risk seen in equities. The massive debt issuances from the biggest tech players are flowing into the same specific credit indices, creating a single point of failure.
So if one of these hyperscalers misses an interest payment, it's not just a tech problem, it's a contagion event for the entire credit market.
Stepping back, the interest rate component adds a layer of duration risk. If we see rapid interest rate movements, it could trigger a positive correlation where rates, credit spreads, and equities all sell off simultaneously. We're already seeing high-yield spreads trading at historically tight levels, around 245 to 250 basis points, which fails to account for what happens to EBITDA and leverage ratios if we hit a growth downturn.
It's the classic everything is fine until the floor disappears scenario.
And the floor is built on some very specific assumptions.
Take SpaceX.
The market is pricing it at a $2 trillion valuation, which, as Bloomberg Surveillance highlighted, is fundamentally disconnected from its current $18 billion in revenue. Compare that to Meta, which has a $1.5 trillion market cap on $200 billion in revenue. But the market is betting on the space-based data center model. There is a belief that SpaceX's satellite constellation will provide the massive AI inference power required to scale fleets like Tesla's Robotaxi. This is why the IPO is so oversubscribed. Investors are trying to capture the infrastructure of the future, even if the current multiples are absurd.
It's a beautiful vision, provided the satellites actually stay in orbit and the electricity stays cheap.
But the electricity is the bottleneck. The massive capital expenditure required for AI data centers is creating a wall of supply that could limit excess returns. Even if you have the technology, you have the financing problem. In the heavy-duty vehicle sector, for example, electrification is hitting a wall not because of the batteries themselves, but because of residual value risk. If financiers can't predict how long a battery will last, they can't value the fleet, and the credit for the transition dries up.
So we have massive tech companies using secondary equity raises to drain liquidity, leaving the rest of the market thirsty, while the energy sector is stuck in a valuation gap between the boring utilities and the miracle deep tech plays.
And the legal landscape is changing to match that chaos. We're seeing a rise in bankruptcy hardball and liability management exercises. Power is shifting away from minority creditors and U.S. judges toward majority creditors who use a menu of options across different jurisdictions. FICC Focus noted that U.S. legal influence in London's insolvency market is now quantifiable, with over 50% of top-ranked London insolvency lawyers now practicing for U.S.-based firms. It's a globalized, highly sophisticated way to restructure debt that favors the biggest players.
It sounds like a game where the rules are being rewritten by the people who are winning.
And the winners are using every tool available. Even the way we move money is changing. As David Beckworth argued, the move toward using U.S.-based stablecoin issuers for trade could act as a tool for financial statecraft. By paying for imports via stablecoins rather than traditional wire transfers, the U.S. can keep the underlying treasury collateral onshore, preventing the creation of offshore dollar liabilities. It's about securing the plumbing of the dollar market, much like the transition from LIBOR to SOFR moved us toward a model centered on pristine treasury collateral rather than subjective bank assessments.
So the goal is to tighten the grip on the dollar while the equity markets are simultaneously being loosened by this massive wave of new supply.
It's a paradox. You're seeing a war for capital where established giants like Alphabet and Amazon are performing large-scale secondary equity, raises specifically to mop up the liquidity before the likes of SpaceX and OpenAI can hit the market. They are essentially preempting the new era.
It's a high-stakes game of musical chairs, and the music is getting faster.
And the chairs are getting more expensive.
Energy investors need to stop looking at tech valuations in isolation and start looking at how much capital is being diverted from physical infrastructure to fund these digital empires.
Keep a close eye on the SpaceX bond issuances. If they fail to secure that investment-grade rating despite their massive equity buffer, the entire strategy of using equity to fund debt-centric capital structures collapses.
But as we watch the capital markets rearrange themselves, we have to wonder how these shifting flows will impact the most volatile bottleneck in the global energy supply. Every time we look at the Middle East, it feels like we're caught between two equally terrifying forces: the sudden violent impulse for total kinetic warfare and this strange, creeping, institutionalized chaos that just refuses to settle into a predictable pattern. Today, we are trying to untangle that tension specifically within the Strait of Hormuz. So, Alex, looking at the wreckage of the last few months, are you betting on a sudden, catastrophic break in the global energy supply, or are we just entering a new, permanent era of expensive, messy inefficiency?
I'd argue we are currently operating in a state of unrecognized stability, though the foundation is incredibly brittle. If you look at the data, the massive price spikes everyone feared during the February blockade haven't materialized in the way the headlines suggested. Traders are calculating that the actual loss of supply is closer to 5 or 6 million barrels per day, rather than the 12 to 15 million initially feared.
So the world isn't quite ending, but it's certainly sweating. But if the supply loss isn't as massive as the panic suggested, why are we seeing these massive, jagged price jumps in specific fuels? It's not like everything is moving up in a neat, synchronized line.
That's because the impact is highly uneven across the commodity complex. Argus Media noted that the Middle East conflict caused disproportionate volatility, while gasoline only saw a roughly 50% price increase because it represents a smaller share of the volume passing through the strait. Other products are much more sensitive. We've seen jet fuel surge by 100 to 110% and diesel by around 90%.
Right, so if you're an airline, you're having a much worse Tuesday than if you're running a local gas station. But this brings us to the how of the market. We have this strange phenomenon where the U.S.-Iran conflict is physically rerouting the entire planet's plumbing.
The implication runs deeper. It's a massive reconfiguration of trade flows. Before this, the market operated on a north surplus or balanced logic, but the conflict has pushed Asia into a short position. Because they can no longer rely on the steady flow through Hormuz, Asian refiners are forced to source supplies from much further away, specifically the U.S. Gulf Coast and Europe. This has transformed Europe from a stable structural exporter into a high-premium swing supplier for Asia, driving the east-west spread to unprecedented peaks of nearly $160 per cubic meter.
Europe is essentially sitting on the sidelines, waiting to see who pays the most for their leftovers. But even with these long-haul voyages, we aren't seeing the absolute breakdown in crude prices that a total blockade would trigger. Is there a hidden cushion we aren't seeing?
There is a very significant, though largely unacknowledged, buffer. Bloomberg Surveillance highlighted that the apparent stability in oil prices despite significant production losses is actually being sustained by the massive drawdown of global inventories, specifically about 400 million barrels of commercial stocks and another 400 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We are essentially burning through our emergency savings to keep the lights on.
That sounds like a very expensive way to avoid a panic. It's like using your retirement fund to pay for a sudden spike in heating bills.
And that's the abundance illusion. Unhedged warned that this creates a massive systemic risk. As we continue to deplete these reserves to manage the current volatility, the global economy becomes dangerously vulnerable. If we hit a new period of infrastructure damage, we could see a sudden violent spike toward $1.50 per barrel because there is no longer a buffer left to absorb the shock.
Let's talk about the new normal for the Strait itself, though. It's not just about missiles and mines anymore. It's getting bureaucratic. I keep hearing about this new Persian Gulf Strait Authority. It sounds like a way to make a war zone feel like a toll road.
It is essentially the institutionalization of maritime control. The PGSA emerged in May 2026, and as of June 2nd, we saw 300 non-Iranian vessels applying for clearance just to navigate the waterway. While the U.S. has sanctioned the PGSA and is maintaining a blockade on certain Iranian ports, there's a dangerous precedent being set. Argus Media pointed out that accepting these transit fees for international waterways could embolden other littoral states, like those near the Straits of Malacca, to implement their own similar tolling regimes.
The playbook for the future is just find a choke point and start charging admission. It's brilliant in a terrifying way. But does the Trump administration actually have a way to stop this, or are they just playing a very high-stakes game of poker with the oil markets?
The strategy seems to be decoupled negotiations. According to Unhedged, the administration is prioritizing a short-term goal, reopening the Strait of Hormuz and lifting the blockade to stabilize immediate U.S. pump prices, while intentionally deferring the much more complex, high-stakes nuclear technicalities to a secondary phase. It's a way to try and create a period of low volatility without actually solving the underlying conflict.
Which, if you listen to the more skeptical voices, looks a lot like jobbing.
It might be.
Macro voices observed that President Trump's repetitive claims of an imminent Iran peace deal, noted 39 times since February 28, act as an effective mechanism for scaring speculators out of the market and keeping prices lower through sheer rhetoric.
But rhetoric doesn't fix a broken pipeline. Even if they reach an agreement to let ships through, you can't just flip a switch and restart the global energy flow.
You're absolutely right. There is a significant physical and technical supply lag. Even if a memorandum of understanding is signed, there is the issue of infrastructure damage in Qatar and the UAE that ship owners are still wary of. And more importantly, Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the true bottleneck isn't just the physical damage, but the technical controlled manner required to restart shut-in wells and pipelines to avoid catastrophic pressure surges. You can't just blast the valves open.
So we are stuck in this limbo. A no-peace, no-war state where the U.S. Navy is tightening the blockade, the Shadow Fleet is using ship-to-ship transfers to bypass the rules, and Saudi Aramco is rerouting crude through the Red Sea to bypass the strait entirely. It's a world of workarounds.
It's a structural decoupling of freight rates from underlying demand. The tanker market is no longer moving based on how much oil people are consuming, but based on the massive increase in ton-mile demand as ships are forced to take much longer, more expensive routes to avoid the conflict zones.
Even if we can't fix the strait, the way we move energy is being permanently rewritten. Refiners in the US and Europe need to keep a very close eye on the technical restart schedules for those shut-in wells in the Gulf. We'll be watching for any signal of a sudden drop in global commercial inventories, because that would tell us the buffer is officially gone. But if the geography of the Middle East is becoming too volatile to trust, does the real power shift toward the more stable, distant basins of the Americas? 100 gigawatts. That was the global milestone for energy storage deployment in 2025, and if you look at the sheer scale of that number, it's easy to think we've already solved the energy transition.
It's a massive number, but it's more about a change in the underlying physics of the market than a finish line. We are seeing a fundamental reorientation from peak climate to what some are calling peak power. The focus has moved away from transportation and EVs toward the raw capacity of the grid itself.
We've stopped worrying about how we move people and started worrying about whether we can even keep the lights on.
As Jessica Uhl noted on the Columbia Energy Exchange, the immediate, insubstantial demand for electricity, driven by the AI boom and massive electrification, is overriding long-term decarbonization momentum. The driver isn't just a climate mandate anymore, it's energy security and affordability.
I love that. We're pivoting from saving the planet to not having a blackout in July. It's much more relatable.
It's a structural shift. Redefining energy describes this as a bifurcation. We have electrons like solar and wind, which follow predictable exponential cost curves in molecules like gas and oil, which are subject to nonlinear geopolitical shocks. The goal now is an economic transition strategy, deploying only what is economically rational to have energy import exposure in places like the UK and EU by 2040.
But if we're just following the money, are we actually building more stability or just more expensive complexity?
The complexity is actually where the arbitrage lives. Energy storage is no longer just a solar companion, it's becoming a standalone high-efficiency tool. In the US, we saw 17.75 GW added in 2025 alone. As Noah Roberts of the Energy Storage Coalition observed, developers are now siting batteries near aging fossil fuel plants to mitigate transmission congestion. They are essentially using the cheapest megawatt to replace the most expensive megawatt during peak demand.
We're basically using batteries as a giant automated middleman to keep prices from spiking.
So here's the picture. There is a massive gap in the middle. Lithium-ion is great for that 0 to 8 hour window, but Energy Evolution points out a critical reliability gap for extreme weather events that can last up to 45 days. That's where long-duration tech like iron-air batteries comes in. They can be 3 to 4 times cheaper than lithium-ion for long-duration discharge.
Okay, but I assume we aren't just magically manifesting iron-air batteries overnight.
No, and that's the bottleneck. It's not about a lack of scientific breakthroughs like fusion, it's about industrial scaling. Matteo Jaramillo of Form Energy has noted that the shift to third-party project finance for these long-duration technologies depends on a multi-year period of demonstrated field performance to de-risk the tech risk. Until then, we're still heavily reliant on the self-financing capacity of regulated utilities.
So we're in this awkward waiting room between proven lithium and unproven iron.
And that tension is being squeezed by the AI boom. Massive data centers for clients like Amazon and Oracle are creating localized demand hotspots in places like California and Texas. Utilities like DTE are already using multi-project storage arrays just to manage that sudden load growth. It's no longer about simple capacity expansion. It's about elegant system design to ensure these loads don't break the grid.
Investors in the power infrastructure space need to stop looking at carbon offsets and start looking at grid interconnection queues.
We'll see if the first major wave of independent, long-duration iron-air projects can actually hit their performance targets without a utility safety net.
But all this massive, power-hungry infrastructure is about to hit a much more expensive bottleneck, the silicon and chips required to make the intelligence run. A year ago, the big question about AI was whether the models actually worked. Now, it turns out the real question is whether we can find enough electricity and copper to keep them from melting the grid.
We've moved from a software debate to a massive industrial build-out. It's no longer just about tokens per second. It's about the physical scarcity of transformers, optical fiber, and the sheer power required to sustain these clusters.
It's getting a bit absurd. We're seeing companies essentially repurposing residential real estate and energy turbines just to expand compute capacity. It's like trying to build a skyscraper, but instead of ordering more steel, you just start cannibalizing the neighboring parking garages.
That's exactly what's happening with the NeoCloud model. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that SpaceX is pivoting from proprietary software like Grok toward leasing compute capacity to competitors like Anthropic. They're transforming from a high-margin software play into what is essentially a lower-margin equipment leasing business.
We're turning the most advanced technology on Earth into a glorified utility company.
And that utility-style demand is creating a massive commodity-style market. According to Odlots, the emergence of a GPU commodities market is driven by a critical lack of fungibility. You can see up to a 38% performance variance in A100 chips depending on the CPU, RAM, and even the geolocation of the data center.
Wait, so I can't just buy a chip like I buy a bushel of wheat? Every single unit is a slightly different snowflake.
The data tells a story, that's why we're seeing the financialization of the hardware. Carmen Lee of Compute Exchange explains that the market is moving from bilateral contracts to sophisticated financial instruments like CME futures. Because individual chip configurations can exhibit price volatility of up to 100%, traders are using normalized indices to track a more stable 20% to 30% daily volatility range.
But even with all this trading, the physical bottleneck is still there. You can trade a paper contract for a B200 chip all day, but if there's no power to run it, the contract is worthless.
And that's the AI-to-power domino effect. As CTVC by Sightline Climate pointed out, the sustainability of the energy IPO wave depends on whether these AI mega IPOs can actually convert into downstream power purchase orders. The real winners right now aren't necessarily the ones designing the next LLM, but the energy-adjacent services like Solve Energy that can deploy existing infrastructure to meet demand today.
Infrastructure investors need to watch their capital expenditure timing. Keep an eye on the next round of municipal bond issuances to see if that new money for utility expansion actually materializes. But if we can't even stabilize the energy needed for a data center, how are we going to manage the mounting pressure on global food supplies and crop yields? I've decided that the global food supply chain isn't actually a chain, it's just a series of unfortunate, disconnected accidents.
That's a bit dramatic, Maya, even for you. We're seeing massive structural shifts in commodity volatility, specifically in agriculture, where weather and trade policy are creating very clear causal chains.
right? Like the perfect storm mentioned on Odd Lots, where the 17% anti-dumping tariff on Mexican tomatoes from July 2025 collided with a 3-4% drop in Mexican production. It's not just bad luck, it's a math problem.
There's a signal here, it's not just trade. In the tomato market, Jacob Krempel from Balder Specialty noted that Florida freezes destroyed 80% of crops, decimated the domestic winter supply. When you add rising fuel prices and labor shortages at the border driving California to East Coast truck rates from $11,000 to $17,000, the cost of moving a single tomato becomes a massive margin killer.
It's lovely how a little frost and a bit of expensive diesel can make a tomato cost nearly $3 a pound.
It's more systemic than that. We are seeing a tornado of compounding variables. In the fertilizer complex, Mike Nash has identified a trend of permanent demand destruction. High urea prices in Europe are driving a shift toward domestic nitrates, while high phosphorus feedstock costs and the closure of the Strait of Hormuz are creating massive supply risks. This leads to crop switching, where farmers reduce acreage for high-input crops like corn in favor of more viable options like rapeseed.
We're basically just replacing one expensive crop with another and calling it adaptation.
It's more about survival. Even in the hay market, the Missouri pattern of western drought is driving price spikes in the Midwest. Because transportation costs are so high, up to $8 per mile, we don't see national price convergence. To cope, high-quality dairy operations are employing ration dilution, mixing high-quality alfalfa with lower-quality hay just to maintain milk volumes while controlling costs.
Dairy farmers are essentially just diluting the problem. Grocery procurement officers need to lock in long-duration contracts before these seasonal hedges evaporate in the next 6 months. Watch the U.S. corn planting acreage. If it dips significantly below the 95 million acre estimate, the shortage is officially structural. As we wrap up this edition, it is impossible to view these developments in isolation. Whether we are looking at the massive debt issuances from hyperscalers, the widening spreads in high-yield credit, or the supply disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz, a singular thread emerges. We are witnessing the physicalization of the digital economy. The era of software-only growth has collided with the hard reality of resource scarcity. The massive capital flows into SpaceX and OpenAI are no longer just bets on code. They are massive, multi-trillion-dollar mandates for copper, lithium, and most critically, baseload electricity.
Exactly, Maya. And the primary implication here is a fundamental shift in the risk calculus for energy project developers and industrial financiers. We are moving away from a world where you could bank on cheap, abundant energy to power your expansion. Now the margin for error has evaporated. For the executives at major utilities and the commodities traders managing midstream logistics, the strategic priority is no longer just capacity, it is certainty. If you cannot guarantee a stable high-voltage connection or a secure maritime corridor, your entire capital structure is at risk. The transition from a focus on decarbonization to a desperate scramble for energy security is forcing a pivot toward equity-heavy, much more expensive ways to build the infrastructure that the AI revolution demands.
It's a high-stakes game where the bottleneck isn't the algorithm, but the transformer and the tanker.
It's a telling detail. So as we look ahead, keep a very close eye on the next round of U.S. energy storage deployment figures. If the growth in grid-scale battery capacity fails to keep pace with the skyrocketing localized demand from data center clusters, we will know that the compute economy has officially hit a physical ceiling.
Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday edition. We'll see you next week.